of Islam to some neighboring countries, to Great Iran at that time, but the Holy Prophet was not able to do so. Of course, no Sunni will believe in this. Mm-hmm. All the Sunnis, they also believe that the Holy Prophet is much more greater and more perfect than all the three caliphs. So the same is true about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. If Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is able, based on the verses and narrations, to make the religion of Islam as the only religion of the world, it doesn't require that he is superior to the Prophet. The Holy Prophet, he had many goals. For many reasons, he was not able to reach all the goals. But for great personalities, not to reach some of their goals doesn't mean that, as I mentioned in the first program, there is something wrong in their personality. No, there are obstacles in them reaching their goals. So we say the same about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. If Sunnis believe that the first three caliphs, they were right in doing so and their actions are true, our question is that, do you believe that the caliphs are superior to the Prophet because of these new achievements? Of course not. They do not believe in such a thing. So we can say the same thing about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. If he is able, of course, he is able to realize that divine promise, لِوِزْ هِلَهُ حَلَى الدِّينَ كُلِّهِ, it doesn't mean that he is superior.
The last Savior.
The question comes to my mind, what next? What next?
There are references to a person who will come as the savior of mankind.
I know he's one of the Ahlul Bayt and the last one, and he's going to change the world.
Shaykhna, another part of this doubt may raise from this part, that actually there is a hadith that says at the time of the appearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, if the knowledge and science has developed and progressed for two letters, Imam will bring the 25 more letters and will perfect the whole knowledge and science for human beings. That is, he will make it 27. I mean, this can also be, from one side, a good, let's say, excuse to resort to say that, okay, the other prophets and imams and, let's say, all the prophets in the course of history were not able to bring the science and knowledge for human being except two letters, but Mahdi will bring 25 more letters and he will perfect the knowledge and science of human beings. Can it also be interpreted in this way, so that this person finds a sort of excuse to focus and attack the school of Ahlul Bayt from?
First of all, when we talk about the knowledge of our Prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, we have many narrations which tell us that all the 14 infallibles are the same with regards to the divine knowledge. Of course, the Holy Prophet is the source of the knowledge. In some parts, Imam Hadi alayhi salam learns something from the Prophet. So according to our narrations, we cannot claim that the knowledge of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is more than the knowledge of the Prophet. Specifically about our Prophet, we have many narrations which tell us that, there is no difference between the Prophet and other infallibles, imams, regarding the divine knowledge. But when we refer to this narration, it is true that we have this narration which reads that al-ilmu sab'atun wa 'ishruna harfa, there are 27 letters or part for knowledge. What has been brought by all the prophets is only two parts, and the remaining 25 parts will be revealed by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This Wahhabi scholar claims that this narration is talking about all the prophets, mm-hmm. including Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. So he knew only two parts of knowledge, but Mahdi knows the entire 27 parts, which requires that Mahdi, according to Shia, is more perfect and more knowledgeable than the Prophet. The answer to this point is that this is a wrong understanding of this narration. At least there are two ways for understanding this narration. The first way of understanding this narration is that the prophets only knew two parts, but mm-hmm. the second understanding is that no, the prophets knew the whole 27 parts, but because of the fact that people at their time were not able to fathom all the other remaining 25 parts,
they did not have the readiness for that.
Exactly, they did not give the people the remaining knowledge. They did not preach the remaining parts of knowledge. True. In the narration, we have the sentence, فَجَمِيعُ مَا جَاءَتْ بِهِ الرَّسُولِ. All what was brought by the prophets. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that all what was known by the prophets.
Very true.
So it requires that what was brought by the prophet was only two parts. Doesn't mean that the prophet did not know the remaining 25 parts. At least this sentence doesn't require that they did not know the remaining 25 parts. Another mm-hmm. sentence in this narration is that فَلَمْ يَعْرِفَ النَّاسْ حَتَّى الْيَوْمْ غَيْرُ الْحَرْفَيْنِ. Up until today, people only know two parts. You see, again, this narration is talking about the knowledge of the people, not the knowledge of the prophets. So we can claim that at least there is a possibility that this narration is referring to the fact that because of the fact that people at the time of the prophets, they did not have, as you mentioned, the readiness of understanding mm-hmm. All those parts of the knowledge, the prophets, although they knew those remaining parts, but they did not give that knowledge to the people. Imagine, for example, if Prophet Nuh alayhi salam wanted to tell the people about modern technologies like electricity, airplane, and so on and so forth. No one was able to understand. So the same is true about the other prophets. We do not know about the content of the remaining 25 parts at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So the point is that at least this narration does not prove that the prophets did not know the remaining 25 parts.
Very true. Thank you very much for this logical and intellectual answer to the question that was posed. I hope that the whole doubt was answered totally and comprehensively, and it was quite informative too, as to me myself. Many thanks, Sheikh Murtada, for having this enlightenment on the topic. I'd just like to ask and invite the respected listeners to inshallah join us in our upcoming session, where we shall find another doubt or misconceptions on the topic of Mahdawi or Mahdism, and we'll focus and answer that doubt. Till then, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjaj bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
Around the world with reporters. anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All Under One Banner's Kerr now is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people, who are recognised as a Celtic minority, have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
I've got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them, and the way that sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down Number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites reveal the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking, and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashrai, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S., even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In
number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Ghadanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal al-Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushra al-Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue. And we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In less
less than 2 months, Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi will take over power, and speculations over the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal is now the talk of the town, while there are still major sticking points in the Vienna talks over the revival of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the discussions are likely to reach a conclusion before the end of President Hassan Rouhani's term in mid-August.
There is a good possibility that we will reach an agreement before the end of our tenure.
In his weekly briefing, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the U.S. is slowing down the process.
Iran and the U.S. still have differences over some of the issues. What's ahead is for the U.S. to make a political decision and lift the sanctions.
Reports coming out of Vienna suggest that the excessive demands of the U.S. and European parties to the deal are to blame for the sluggish talks. The U.S. wants the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in exchange for only a temporary suspension of some of the anti-Iran sanctions, a demand beyond Iran's commitments under the accord. In his first presser as president-elect, Raisi made it clear that the U.S. must lift all sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance to the atomic accord. He said he will not allow the talks to become erosive.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The U.S. was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action or the JCPOA, the nuclear deal has been in limbo for 3 years since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In a tit-for-tat, Tehran adopted a stepwise suspension of its own nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, way above the 3.67% cap set by the deal. The Iranian Foreign Ministry hopes the Vienna talks will conclude before Rouhani's term is over. Observers say this scenario is the best for the U.S., and any foot-dragging means the talks will have to continue with the new Iranian administration, which maintains a tougher tone toward the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard by people in power, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
Police now, for the first time, are going to have the ability to restrict static protests or even to ban static protests. Now, making too much noise is going to be regarded as something that could be problematic. There's also a provision in the bill for a new crime of creating a public nuisance, which has, incredibly, a prison sentence of up to 10 years attached to it.
And it was those provisions in the bill that got people out on the streets over the past year, not just in London, but up and down the country.
Parliamentary committee's warning echoes campaigners' concerns that the policing bill is deeply imbalanced. Apart from issuing unwarranted curbs, such as noise limits on protests, they say, it does too little to protect women. That it metes out longer jail terms, let's say for vandalism, than it does for sexual assault.
The government response has been one of denial and defiance. Our proposed measures, it says, are in line with human rights legislation and in no way impinge on the right to protest.
There is no such thing as a protest that doesn't in some way impinge or disrupt other people in society. That's the point. That's the nature of protest. There's a kind of hostility to the very kind of philosophical notion and nature of protests right at the heart of this bill, and that's why we shouldn't believe it.
The contentious legislation came after protests by the Extinction Rebellion movement that first began in 2018 and last year's toppling of the statue of a slave trader in the southwestern city of Bristol during the BLM protests. The UK government has a majority in Parliament. It remains to be seen if the ongoing protests, the warning from the Committee on Human Rights, and concerns among some of its own libertarian MPs would prevent the draft legislation from becoming law. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran
Once AB Holm and several lawyers have filed a complaint against Mölnlycke Healthcare, a Swedish medical device company, over its refusal to sell medical products to Tehran under US pressures. Mölnlycke Healthcare refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation. Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items.
Since May 2018, that the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, up to May 2019, a number of children suffering from EB died only because they did not have Mepilex dressings. I want to tell those who claim to be defenders of human rights what has been the crime of this 37-day-old baby who died of the disease only because we did not have Mepilex dressings as a result of the U.S. sanctions.
The move has deprived EB patients, also known as butterfly patients, of essential medical items, killed many of them, especially children, and inflicted serious physical injuries, such as amputation, to some of the patients. The complaint seeks to protect the victims of the open violation of human rights committed by the Swedish company and prevent similar criminal measures.
The Iranian Center for International Criminal Law, an NGO based in The Hague, has submitted a complaint to the Swedish National Contact Point stating that the Swedish company had breached the OECD guidelines by failing to undertake appropriate human rights due diligence, adversely affecting the human rights of EB patients in Iran and failing to remedy its impact. The lawsuit calls on Swedish National Contact Point to hold the company accountable and take action to compensate for the losses Iranian EB patients have suffered and to resume trading with Iran.
Nearly 30 Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran, saying that for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iranian officials have repeatedly blasted the U.S. for imposing sanctions against the country, stressing that such inhumane sanctions have intensified the sufferings of kids with no access to special medicines for incurable diseases. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi has highlighted the principles of his government's foreign policy in his first news conference since his election last week. Raisi took a jab at the US and Europe for the failure to live up to their commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The US was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
This comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in talks in the Austrian capital to revive the accord, which has been hanging in the balance since former US President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Raisi said his government will support negotiations that ensure Iran's national interests, but also made it clear that his foreign policy will not be limited to the nuclear pact.
Maximum pressure hasn't worked on our people, and so they must reconsider and return. Our people have shown that they resist pressures, and they must know that foreign policy of our administration does not start with the JCPOA and will not be limited to it either.
And this is how he responded to calls by some Western countries for including Iran's missile program in the Vienna talks to revive the JCPOA.
Iran's regional and missile programs are not negotiable. They have not fulfilled their commitments regarding issues that have already been negotiated and agreed upon. How can they enter into new discussions?
Raisi said his administration will focus on an expansive and balanced interaction with the world
and would also be open to restoring ties with Saudi Arabia.
Ties with neighboring countries will be my administration's priority. With regard to ties with Saudi Arabia, there is no obstacle from the Iranian side to the reopening of embassies within the two countries.
Raisi also touched on the Saudi-led war on Yemen, calling for an immediate end to the conflict. Tehran has stressed that it seeks to establish ties with all countries based on mutual respect. Now it seems to be seen how Western and regional countries will deal with the new administration when Raisi takes office in August after he won over 60% of the vote in last week's election.
The week that saw British PM Boris Johnson's Conservative Party lose a previously safe parliamentary seat to the Liberal Democrats in a by-election northwest of London had another surprise in store. Former Parliament Speaker John Bercow changing allegiances and joining the opposition Labour Party and sharing harsh words about the Conservative Party and its leader.
If you believe, as I do, that this government is bad news, unfit to govern, and that the Prime Minister, though a successful campaigner, is a lousy governor.
The former Parliament Speaker went on to describe the Prime Minister as someone who has only a nodding acquaintance with the truth in a leap year, and complimented Labour leader Keir Starmer as an honest man.
His move to Labour signifies the sort of internal corruption and hostile and aggressive attitude, the return of the nasty party in terms of this current government.
John Bercow wasn't always anti-conservative. In fact, he started his career in 1997 as a self-described rabid right-winger and served as a conservative MP for 12 years, but says his political stripes have changed.
My values are left of center. I do not identify with the Conservative Party.
In 2009, he was elected as Parliament Speaker, a job he kept for the next 10 years. Although he kept his links with his former party, he wasn't very popular with the Conservative MPs, especially over Brexit. That led to the Prime Minister not putting his name forward for peerage. Bercow denies his pivot to Labour has anything to do with it.
Bercow's explanation of why he joined the Labour Party bears credence. The modern context of the Tory Party is one of corruption, one of regressive policy. In very many areas, including international aid, one of cronyism at the highest level.
The UK Parliament's first Jewish former speaker also described the Conservative Party and its leader Boris Johnson as reactionary, populist, nationalistic, and sometimes even xenophobic.
Bercow insists that his pivot to the left is not personal against the Prime Minister, that he has reached a conclusion that the current government needs to be replaced, and that the only vehicle through which to achieve that objective is the Labour Party. Site for is up, London.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson: The Believer is Useful. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Do you know palm tree? Palm tree is actually one of the very fertile trees. Its fruits are eaten as one of the best foods, and sometimes its stone is burnt. Also, things like mats, hats, tablecloth are woven from its leaves. Its wood is used in construction of simple buildings and also used as a bridge for passing through streams. A fragrant and useful essence is extracted from its blossoms. In other words, there is no one part of palm tree that is discarded as useless. This is the nature This is a creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, why are we talking about palm tree? What happened here? So the believers, you know, I want to draw a parallel. The believers are like that. They are the same. Their thoughts are useful. Their speeches are profitable. Their meetings are educational. Their religion reforms the society, and they are loyal in friendship, strong in their decisions. In short, everything about believers is worthy. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, a believer is like a palm tree. Whatsoever you take away from it is useful and profitable. See how beautiful Islam is and how beautiful the simile is that the Prophet has provided for us. If you want to be a believer, if you consider yourself to be a believer, then make sure that you are beneficial for others. You are profitable for others. The others are benefiting from your presence, from your talks, from your thoughts. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing that a believer is useful, profitable, helpful. Now, you know, we gave an example of a palm tree before the break. Let's break down what we mean by thoughts of a believer are beneficial for others. So brothers and sisters, everybody thinks, right? So everybody uses their mind, they think, they process information, they come up with things they have to say. But there are those believers whose thoughts are always constructive and beneficial for others. Now this is something one has to get, you know, to a point where they can be positive all the time in this sense of the constructiveness and beneficialness, if you would. The idea is that whatever a believer thinks, his thoughts are pure. They are not full of hypocrisy. They're not, you know, making things up to make others happy, or they're not doing things or, you know, thinking about doing things that are going to upset other people. Similarly, speech of a believer is educational and is aimed at development, right? Sometimes we all speak, we know that, right? So sometimes when we speak, our words are, or sometimes the choice of words, sometimes our thoughts, they're not so pleasant. But what we are taught by Islam is that our speech has to be educational in nature and is aimed at development. Just the regular talk I'm talking about. It's not the speech that you give on podium. All the time when you speak, it should be beneficial for others. Meetings and gatherings of believers are educational and spiritual. You know, one of the things we see, sometimes we hang out with friends and we let loose. You know, sometimes we think that, oh, it's just a casual hangout. No. If you're a believer, if you consider yourself to be a believer, then your gatherings are supposed to be educational and spiritual. Similarly, in your friendships, you have to be loyal. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. be English radio.
In the limelight.
The Great Barrier Reef should be placed on to a list of World Heritage Sites that are in danger, according to a recommendation from UN officials that urges Australia to take accelerated action at all possible levels on climate change. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Graham Redfern Ryder. This article is published under the heading, UNESCO recommends Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Site should be listed as in danger. Stay tuned for more. The Great Barrier Reef should be placed onto a list of World Heritage Sites that are in danger, according to a recommendation from UN officials that urges Australia to take accelerated action at all possible levels on climate change. The United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization says the world's biggest coral reef system should be placed on the list at the World Heritage Committee meeting next month. If the committee followed the recommendation, experts said it would be the first time a natural World Heritage Site has been placed on in the danger list, mainly because of impacts from the climate crisis. Global heating caused by fossil fuel burning has driven ocean temperatures higher, leading to three mass bleaching events on the 2,300-kilometer reef since the last time it was assessed by the committee in 2015. World Heritage Sites are global icons, and endangered listings are usually recommended after effects from armed conflict and war, pollution, poaching, and uncontrolled urbanization. The UNESCO report says a revision of Australia's key reef policy, the Reef 2050 Plan, should fully incorporate conclusions from a major government review that accelerated action at all possible levels is required to address the threat from climate change. The report said despite efforts and achievements by the state and federal governments, key targets on improving water quality had not been met. It said the plan requires a stronger and clearer commitments, in particular towards urgently countering the effects of climate change, but also towards accelerating water quality improvement and land management measures. Environment Minister Susan Lee said the recommendation followed a complete subversion of normal process. She said officials had been reassured a week ago that UNESCO would not be recommending the reef be placed on the danger list. Lee said climate change was the biggest threat to the reef, but the World Heritage Committee was not the forum to make a point about climate change. This decision was flawed, and clearly there was politics behind it, and that has subverted the proper process. For the World Heritage Committee not to foreshadow this listing is appalling, she told reporters recently. She said there were more than 80 World Heritage properties that UNESCO had identified as under threat from climate change. The government may have understood if the body decided to list all of them as in danger, but it had singled out the reef, she said. UNESCO is also recommending that a monitoring mission be launched to develop corrective measures, asking the Queensland and federal governments to submit a report by February 2022 outlining new steps to protect the reef. The conservation groups WWF Australia and the Australian Marine Conservation Society have lobbied members of the committee before the reef decision, asking them to pressure Australia to take a stronger action on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. A consultant to the AMCS, Imogen Zetoven, said Australia's climate policies were more consistent with a 2.5 to 3 degrees Celsius rise in global average temperature, a level that would destroy the Great Barrier Reef and all the world's coral reefs. She said the Australian government in action had led the reef to brink of in danger listing. Richard Leck, head of oceans at WWF Australia, said Australians would be shocked by the UNESCO recommendation, but it was a powerful message that the government needed to lift its game on climate change. Australia's greenhouse gas emissions targets have not changed since 2015, and the Prime Minister Scott Morrison has resisted international pressure to adopt a firm net zero target by 2050. Professor Scott Herron of James Cook University has led a study on the effects of climate change on World Heritage Reef sites. He said the recommendation was a surprise, but also not completely unexpected, adding, "These cards have been stacking up over the past years."
Did you really read all those books, or is it just making an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the Bronx in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Yasser Ibrahim. It is well known and it is written in history that during that particular era of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, many of the youth and the poor were attracted to Islam due to the truthfulness and the righteousness, that is, the Holy Prophet being Amin and Sadiq, and that Muslims in general, that is we, me and you, we are supposed to be the missionaries or the muballighin of Islam, and we are supposed to uphold the best of characters. But unfortunately, as we see with the creation of certain groups such as ISIS and others, that the name of Islam has been ruined and people do not actually go to the books of Islam. Rather, they see these Muslims on TV and say, "Oh, this is Islam." And they, you know, kind of paint over every single Muslim with the same color and with the same brush. What is important is to understand that, you know, Islam, Shia faith, as a religion, being the religion of truth, is not based on who accepts it or who rejects it. It is based on truth because it is truth. What is important that the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today should not be something that, you know, says, "Oh, because such and such a person became Muslim, Islam is the truth." No, this is not what this book is intended to do. This book is intended to increase the faith of those who have faith, and is a point of reference for those who are seeking Islam. It is a motivation for them to go and say, that, okay, if this person found truth in it, what is it that he found truth in? So hence, inshallah, in our next segment, we will be introducing this book onto the right path to our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
I praise Allah for sending me you, my love. You found your home, it's here with me, and I'm here with you. Now let me let you know, you've opened my heart. I was always thinking that love was wrong, but everything was changed when you came along. Oh, and there's a couple words I wanna say. For the rest of my life, I'll be with you. I'll stay by your side, honest and true, to the end of my time. I'll be loving you for the rest of my life. Through days and nights, I'll thank Allah.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We have been discussing the book Onto the Right Path, collected and compiled by Sayyid Saeed Akhtar Rizvi. We've mentioned this individual in one of our previous programs and the great impact that he had on the brothers and sisters living in East Africa, especially the natives living in that particular country. This book was published by an organization in which the Blessed Sayyid had a hand in, you know, establishing. The organization known as Bilal Muslim Mission of Tanzania. So in this book is a collection of life experiences of people who adhered to the right path. And I mentioned previously, the right path is not because this person accepted or that person accepted. No. In the right path, because it is the right path. We believe it is the right path. Now it's up to others to see it. These stories, you know, will guide a person to seeing that right path, inshallah. It is a booklet that is full of lessons for those seeking the truth and for those who are trying to discover the truth, as I mentioned previously. It is not because so-and-so accepted, we should accept. No. So the book consists of six stories of people who became Shia Muslim. Now, they themselves have written this. They have either given interview or they actually wrote it. For example, one of the individuals in this book who has written his life story in order for it to be published in this book is a person known as Hussein Amin Schwarzer. He is a person from Germany, and he wrote his own life story and he's put it in this book. Another person is a person or a brother whose name is Yusuf Ibrahim Chupi Mackinnon, and he is from the country of Kenya, again on the east coast of Africa. These individuals within these stories explain their journey towards Islam, what, you know, caught their attention, why did they begin learning about Islam, the eventual conversion to Islam, and so on and so forth. So it is a motivation for those who are seeking the truth and an upliftment for those who are Muslim. So that, look, I am following a path that these individuals have found. It is not to say that, no, I'm Muslim and that's it. No, we should try and improve ourselves as Muslims in order to form that particular individual characteristic and character that was essential to the formation of Islam, where people see us and know they are Muslim and are attracted to us because of our characters. So inshallah, in our next section or our next segment, we will be reading a portion of this book, inshallah, for the benefit of our dear listeners. Until then, please stay tuned.
The rhythm of Allah's creation, the rhythm of the clapping of the thunder and the rain. Can you see the rhythm of Allah's creation, the lightning and the leaves and the seasons as they change?
Welcome back to your listeners to our program Bookshelf
on IRIB English Radio. We have been discussing the book Onto the Right Path that was compiled by Sayyid Sayyid Akhtar Rizvi, Rahmatullah Alayh. The book basically discusses conversions to Shia Islam by certain individuals and their stories and how they found the truth of the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. One of those individuals who the book quotes is a lady by the name of Miss Roberta J. Harter. And she's from the United States of America. And later on, she married a person by the name of Haider Ali M. Rajpur. And obviously, she then changed her surname, and she took the name of Shamim. So she writes in this book, or rather, whatever she wrote of her journey in the book is as follows, or a section of it anyway. She begins by saying, I followed the light of Allah. This is how she begins her writing, or her so-called story of her conversion to Islam and the part of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Often certain phrases can make such an impression on our minds that they give us the necessary impetus to search for the deeper and greater meaning behind them. I was born in a Christian home where worship was a beautiful matter of love for God, Christ, and what were regarded as the teachings of the church. Such love must never be scorned, especially when it serves as the guiding force in holding the family and community together. What better concept could act as the cement for holding such structures together? Unfortunately, when one looks more closely at this guiding principle, it is quickly discovered that much of it is based on emotion and willingness through faith to overlook or accept certain inconsistencies which are inherent in the very basis of that principle. The most glaring of these, especially to a Muslim, is the confirmation, on one hand, God is one and eternal, and on the other, He has divided Himself into a Trinity, the parts of which are to be worshipped as though they were still one God. This ends our brief description on the book Onto the Right Path, compiled by Sayyid Sayyid Akhtar Rizvi, Rahmatullah Alayh. So this is the story of the sister, and hopefully we are able to read further, and we ask our listeners to search further for the truth, inshallah. Until next time, Assalamu Alaikum wa Rahmatullah wa Barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.